I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. This is really a great honor for me, I think. Okay, I'm going to talk about pattern information fMRI and representational similarity analysis. Now I'm having a problem here. I seem to be having a problem with my computer. It only works when the screen is off, when the projector is off. It doesn't forward.
Do you have the one of those hotkeys that lets you switch between screen modes?
Yes, let's try.
So now it doesn't work. I can't forward.
Is it blocked at all? No, it's not blocked. That's good.
Oh, now it works. Now we try it again.
It varies from machine to machine.
Yes, it works.
Great, that seems to be solved. So in fMRI, typically we present subjects with stimuli, or more generally we have them go through these mental experiences. And in the case of object vision, fMRI, which is my area of research, those are typically perceptions. These mental events that we're studying are perceptions of stimuli. And then for a given functional region that consists of a number of voxels whose number depends on the resolution and the size of the region, we're interested in how this region responds to those stimuli. So one way of conceptualizing this is in terms of a matrix, which has the stimuli along the vertical and the response channels. So in the case of fMRI, these will be voxels. In the case of single cell recordings, these might be neurons along the horizontal. So we have all these numbers, and we're assuming that there is a single sort of amplitude, response amplitude estimate for each stimulus. So typically in imaging analysis, since the days of PET, people have averaged responses across all the voxels within a region. So when you see ROI analyses in papers, almost always the first thing that's done is average across those voxels. And in when the goal is to map the brain, similarly people smooth the data before mapping. And in the stimulus domain, similarly, typically in fMRI we have a small number of conditions, for example two conditions or maybe five conditions, but not a large number at all. So when the events, the experimental events are stimuli, they're grouped into sets, often categories, predefined categories, and then these are also averaged across. So this reduces this complex matrix to basically two numbers, and one way that this can be described, this approach, is activation analysis. So there is a great step of data reduction. And from a neuroscientific perspective, that seems somewhat unfortunate, because obviously we're interested in the variations across the channels, right? We've been thinking since the 70s, we've been conceptualizing representations of visual stimuli in terms of a population code. Now we have this region of interest. Obviously with fMRI we can't see the single cells that constitute this population code, but still we have a large number of dimensions, and we're throwing away all this information, right? So there's a strong motivation not to average across voxels within a local region. And similarly, there's also a strong motivation not to average across responses to different stimuli. This seems to be making a very strong assumption that they should be all the same, for example, or if they're not, then the averages might not be informative as to what actually happens on a single trial of perception of an object image, say. Nevertheless, there is a good motivation. Of course, statistically, it's great to average the data like that because you get very stable estimates. And more conceptually, this concept of activation, by which I mean sort of blob of activation, is related to the paradigm of studying regional involvement in a given task. So you're contrasting two tasks, and you're interested in which task involves a given region more strongly, right? And the idea is that we can't look into the region. So basically, by and large, the last 5 days were mostly about this approach, actually. And today is about a different approach where we don't average across the response channels, but we kind of honor the distinctions between the responses in individual voxels. And that's been called pattern information analysis, or MVPA, multi-voxel pattern analysis. One of the core goals of my project that I'm going to talk about is to see if we can honor all these distinctions, both the distinctions between response channels and between stimuli at the same time. And of course, it's always a bit of a cheap shot to say you need to honor these distinctions. They might be neuroscientifically relevant. Obviously, from a statistical perspective, we're getting much more variance that we have to deal with if we reduce the bias of the analysis like that, right? So just as in pattern information analysis, where we're no longer averaging across these voxels, we still want to combine the evidence across the voxels, just not by averaging, right? Averaging is one perhaps a particularly uninspired way of combining evidence, right? With pattern classification, as you've heard about this morning, we're combining the evidence, but in a more in a cleverer way, based on a training set that characterizes the contribution of each particular voxel, and so we can potentially extract more information. And now we want to see here if we can do something similar also across the stimuli, although that's a very different problem at the same time. So to give a quick overview of my talk, I'm going to talk about specific neuroscientific experiments, and they focus on inferior temporal object representations in humans and monkeys, measured with fMRI in the humans and with single-cell recording in the monkeys. And at the same time, I want to sort of keep to introduce you to a general methodology in which every stimulus is a condition by itself, which is unconventional for within fMRI. But then at the same time, we also want to have many stimuli, right? So one way of doing this would be to just have four stimuli or two stimuli. And that's actually going to be the first experiment that I'm going to talk about. But at the same time, of course, there is a strong argument for having many stimuli. So then we need to do condition-rich fMRI designs where we have very little data for each condition, and we have a large number of conditions, and we're going to treat them all separately. And then finally, the final methodological aspect is representational similarity analysis, which is a way of analyzing these data that kind of goes in that direction. So a few pointers to the related literature. This is that this whole approach is inspired by and based on. It's about multidimensional scaling, which I'm going to explain to you in detail in a moment. So Torgerson, Kruskal, and Wish, Chappell, the concept of second-order isomorphism, central to this. Multidimensional scaling was first applied to fMRI data in a very early paper by Edelman et al. In 1998, which has some great concepts in it. And there's a number of more recent studies that use different kinds of similarity analyses as well. My collaborators on these projects were Marieke Moore, Douglas Ruff, Jerzy Bedorka, Peter Banditini, Rusbei Kiani, Hossein Esteki, and Keiji Tanaka. So just as a quick overview of the main experiment and analysis, our overall approach, so to speak. We present images of real-world objects to our subjects, humans and monkeys. We measure the brain activity pattern during perception of each particular image, fMRI, by fMRI in the humans and cell recording in the monkeys. And then we study the similarity structure of the object representations, focusing here on inferior temporal IT cortex. And we compare the representations in human and monkey IT between the species by relating representational similarity matrices. And I'm going to explain to you in detail what that means. So a core concept is the concept of the representational similarity matrix. So for every image, we present it to the brain, and then for a given region of interest, we estimate an activity pattern, and we use standard linear modeling with the only quirk that we don't spatially smooth the data at all. So we get sort of an amplitude estimate for every image, and this could be done, and we always do event-related designs, but it doesn't really depend on the design so much. It could be slow event-related or rapid event-related, in which case we'd have overlapping hemodynamic response predictors. So we get an activity pattern that's associated with a particular image within a region of interest, and then although it's conventional, maybe it's good to point out that we interpret this activity pattern as a representation of the image, right? So our idea is that the conceptual paradigm behind all this is that the region represents the images, and it represents them by the patterns, and if two patterns are identical, it means the image doesn't care about the distinction between the two stimuli. And if the patterns are very different, it means that the region cares about this distinction, it represents this distinction. So then, in order to get at this representational similarity of the patterns, we compute the dissimilarity between the activity patterns, and usually we use 1 minus correlation across space, unless otherwise stated. So this gives us, when we repeat this for all pairs of images, and here in this experiment there were only 4 images, so this is a single image experiment, but with only 4 images, we get a dissimilarity matrix, which is diagonal, which has a diagonal of zeros and is symmetric about that diagonal. So in this case, we see from the matrix that it has these larger values between these two categories, between the two faces and the two houses there, are these larger dissimilarities, and within each category, the dissimilarities are smaller. So another way of visualizing this intuitively is by placing the images in 2D such that images that elicited similar response patterns are close together and images that elicited dissimilar response patterns are far apart. And the method that does this using different optimization criteria is multidimensional scaling. So when we do this for this particular case, we get something like this, where these two houses here are close together because their dissimilarities are small, and the two faces are close together for the same reason, and all the between category distinctions are large. The dissimilarities are large between the activity patterns. So here, in addition, I've used the color code to indicate significant multivariate differences. And in this case, and these were estimated using a linear classifier trained on half the data, and then getting the discriminant dimension, projecting the other half of the data onto that, and then just performing a t-test on this in this one-dimensional space. An alternative method would be to look at the accuracy and then do something like chi-square, as you've heard earlier, and that would be conceptually identical and mathematically slightly different. So when we do this for this simple four-image experiment, we do it for different regions, For early visual cortex, we find this pattern that we can distinguish all pairs of images except the two faces. Now, that's plausible and interesting at the same time. It's plausible because the two faces are visually similar. So, for example, if we just correlate the images, since they're in the same view and lighting as well, these images are correlated, whereas the other pairs of images aren't correlated, really. And we know that early visual cortex has a retinotopic representation, so it seems plausible that they would be more similar in this retinotopic representation, particularly also because fMRI is a coarse method, so the main thing that it reflects is sort of the retinotopic information, and the finer orientation information is also present in V1, and that definitely distinguishes these images, will not be reflected as strongly in the fMRI signal. When we move up to ventral temporal cortex, or inferior temporal cortex, we see in the fusiform face area, in the parahippocampal place area, a very similar pattern of responses. It seems to be categorical within this very small image set that doesn't really allow us to assess whether it's categorical or not. But the cross-category dissimilarities are now very large, and the within-categories dissimilarities are very small. And this was somewhat surprising to us for the fusiform face area, because we expected, based on the current theory about the fusiform face area, many people believe that it serves to represent individual faces, and that would suggest that it should sort of blow up this difference between individuals as well as responding to faces in general. But in the fMRI data, at least, we don't see that. And then in anterior inferotemporal cortex, we find a region that seems to distinguish the face images quite strongly. And this region doesn't distinguish any other pairs of images as far as its response is reflected in our fMRI data, of course, right? So this is always a caveat, obviously, a null effect, just as in any other scientific experiment can never be interpreted as indicating that there is no effect at all. So here you see another feature of this visualization, which is that the connections here have different thickness, and I haven't explained that to you yet. This is what I call this a rubber band graph in the back, and this serves to visualize the inevitable distortions that occur when we represent this dissimilarity matrix by a two-dimensional arrangement. The way this works is that's why it's called rubber band. When effects are stretched, they become thinner, and when they're compressed, they become thicker. And so more precisely, the effect, and here it's the effect in bits, it's an estimate with normal assumptions, the effect is proportional to the length times the thickness of these connections. So this brings me to the main experiment, which is the 96 stimulus experiment, in which we use these particular images. So as you can see, these are isolated object images in color, and they span a wide variety of categories that have been discussed in the literature. So there are faces there, and animals and places and tools and man-made objects and natural objects. So our brain activity measurements quickly. In the human, we performed fMRI in four subjects, bringing subjects back for repeated sessions to have a lot of data in each subject. So we had at least 12 runs per subject. The task was to fixate and discriminate fixation point color changes. So the task actually drew attention away from the object images. The task had nothing to do with the images themselves. We had an occipitotemporal measurement slab, high-res voxels of about 2 millimeters width in each dimension, used a 3T magnet and a 16-channel coil, and sense acquisition with an acceleration factor of 2. Our stimulus duration is 300 milliseconds, and we used a quick event-related design, which is sort of halfway between a slow event-related design where the responses don't overlap at all in time, and a rapid event-related design where the responses can overlap quite a lot. So it's kind of a compromise that allows us to accommodate this many different particular conditions in the experiment. In the monkey experiments were performed by my collaborator Ruspe Chiani, and there is a separate paper in the Journal of Neurophysiology on this data set, which I can recommend to you. It's a really great paper. Those were single cell recordings performed in two monkeys. The task similarly was to fixate. The electrodes were in anterior IT, and there were 674 cells in total. So every cell that could be isolated and where we had data for all the images in the set were used for the analysis. The stimulus duration was 105 milliseconds, and the presentation was rapid serial presentation, which is possible in the monkeys because the responses are very rapid as well. So this allowed Ruspe to actually study these particular stimuli and as part of a larger set of over 1,000 images. And in order to get an estimate of the response amplitude of each cell, we used the 140 millisecond windowed spike count starting 71 milliseconds after stimulus onset, so it's capturing the bulk of the response of the cell. So in the human FRI experiment, just a quick look at the design matrix to make this concrete. The images occurred at a SOA of 4 seconds. There were also blank trials in between, but otherwise it was a constant SOA, so it was not jittered. And the stimulus sequence was random, and so we had a large number of random sequences which were never repeated. And the idea of using random sequences here as opposed to using sequence optimization is that we don't want to bias our experimental design or any aspect of our experiment in terms of any grouping of the stimuli. We want to treat each stimulus and each stimulus grouping in exactly the same way. So using random sequences kind of comes closest to that. So you see that those responses are overlapping, but they're not sort of extremely overlapping. We have exactly each stimulus occurs exactly once in a 10-minute run, and then we have multiple runs, and we concatenate them all a long time and make this big design matrix with about 150 predictors that has a single predictor for each of the 96 stimuli, and then trend models and head motion parameter models and confound means separately for each run. So first, let's look at stimulus quartets. Before we looked at these four stimuli in the experiment where we only had four stimuli, here now we're drawing random sets of four and looking at them in a similar way. So for the human, for IT, and this is human IT defined at 1,000 voxels by choosing the voxels within an anatomically defined mask that are most responsive to these object images using a separate data set. And we can look at this arrangement. We see that here, for example, there is a clear odd one out, which is the carrots in this case, and the two monkey faces seem sort of closer together than the hands, so that's quite intuitive and would suggest that IT sort of represents these dissimilarities in an intuitive fashion. If we do this for the monkey, it looks very similar for these 674 cells treated in the same way. And I should say that the way these plots are computed is by using multidimensional scaling with 1 minus Pearson correlation as the distance measure and using metric stress as the optimization criterion. And then in addition, since these come out sort of in a random, each arrangement is sort of in a random orientation, we align them to each other by using the procrustes alignment method. So that's a rigid alignment, just so it's visually easier. So I'm just going to show a number of these to you without too much comment. Here we see something that seems to be the case more generally, that in the monkey, the human faces tend to be closer together than in the human. So, and we also get these sort of funny examples where it doesn't really seem to fit, like this one where in the human, these two wise animals go together and the little boy is kind of separate. Whereas in the monkey, the little boy seems to go with them. So this is all very nice, but it's somehow anecdotal, of course, and we want to first look at the whole image set and then also do statistics on that, obviously. So even though it's redundant, going to go through this again. We have these 96 stimuli. We estimate these response patterns to all of these, compute the dissimilarity matrix, and now we get this 96 by 96 dissimilarity matrix, which is symmetric about a diagonal of zeros, and do the analyses on this basis. So for human IT, the same region that I used for these quartets, defined at 1,000 most visually responsive voxels using independent data, this is the matrix that we get. And the thing that struck me about this that I didn't expect when I was planning these experiments is that just looking at these with the naked eye, we can already see a lot of structure. So why is that not entirely expected? Simply because of the number of parameters that we're estimating here. These are 4,560 parameters, so it's really sort of taking a lot of numbers out of our few runs or two sessions of fMRI data. So I was very happy that just with the naked eye I could discern any structure at all, because my expectation was that this would look like noise, and then I'd do statistics on this to study whether there is any structure in that. And the reason why we see structure here, I think, is the same reason that is responsible for the success of pattern information fMRI in general, which is the combination of evidence across the response channels. So here there are 1,000 voxels, and by comparing these patterns across 1,000 voxels, we're not averaging across the voxels, so we're not combining the evidence in that way, but we are computing the similarity over all of these, so we are combining evidence across these voxels, and that makes these single dissimilarity estimates more stable. So there's two features for this matrix that I want to draw your attention to. One is the distinction between animate and inanimate objects. So whenever a pair of stimuli straddles the animate-inanimate boundary, as is the case for these in the black squares, then the dissimilarity tends to be large. And the second feature, second most prominent feature, is that whenever both stimuli are human faces, then the dissimilarity tends to be particularly small. So now, again, to visualize the representation, we can arrange the images using multidimensional scaling. When we do this for all the 96, this is the arrangement we get, and we see that the animates are all over on one side and the inanimates on the other side. The faces are sort of in a small cluster here. So when we color code that, that becomes very clear. And now we can look at these two representations of the same thing side by side that can give us slightly different perspectives on what's going on in this set of patterns. So now, of course, we're interested in seeing how this changes when we change the definition of the region. For example, we can make human IT larger, defining it at three times as many voxels, which changes it, washes it out a little bit, but still these features that I've drawn your attention to are preserved. Or we can make it smaller, And we see the same qualitatively, a similar pattern of effects. Or we can look at other regions, for example, his human early visual cortex, defined at a similar size. And here we don't see these features of categoricality and this sort of very similar response patterns to the human faces. Although a little bit of that can also show up sometimes in human early visual cortex. So let's look at the monkey matrix computed for these 674 cells. This is what it looks like. And it looks amazingly similar to the human matrix. And this is something that we didn't expect at all to find such a good match because of the great species difference. Also because categorization is sort of a more high-level process that one might expect to be particularly different between the species. And finally, of course, because cell recording and fMRI are such very different ways of sampling these response patterns, and we would expect different information to be sort of prominent in these two measurement techniques. So we can also look and compare the arrangements, and so similar to the matrices, they match very well as well. Another way of taking this one step further is to take these two arrangements and then to link them up. So this makes it easier to see which particular stimulus corresponds to which other stimulus in these two multidimensional scaling arrangements. And here what I've done in addition to that is emphasize the connections between stimuli that are inconsistently represented. So because we saw this great consistency, here we're interested in looking at what's inconsistent between the representations. And the way we estimate that is by just looking at the dissimilarities of a given stimulus to all the other stimuli. So in other words, where is it relative to all of its peers in the human representation and in the monkey representation, and then correlating those two vectors of dissimilarities, which kind of define the position of a stimulus within a given representation. And when that correlation is high, then we say it's sort of consistently represented, and in that case, we draw a very thin connection. So all these thin connections are the consistently represented stimuli, but there are a few that sort of misrepresented, and they tend to also go to different positions in the multidimensional scaling arrangement, although this is, of course, lower dimensional, so can't completely trust that in this respect. So then, of course, to make this a bit more quantitative and ask statistically whether the matrices are related, we can plot the monkey IT dissimilarity versus the human IT dissimilarity. And so for a given pair of images, we have a dissimilarity for monkey IT, looking it up in the monkey matrix, and we have a dissimilarity for human IT. And for example, this pair of images has a large dissimilarity in both species. You look at different examples like this. This one is a little more similar in both of them, and two human faces tend to be much more similar in both of them. So we can repeat this for all the 4,000 something pairs, and then we get the scatter plot of dissimilarities, and we see that there is a correlation. Of course, what this shows us is just what we can see here with the naked eye, that these two matrices are correlated. But then here we can compute the correlation and also do statistics on it. And in this case, what we've done to get a t-value is randomize the stimulus labels repeatedly for one of the matrices, so consistently reordering the rows in the same new order as all the columns, and then recomputing the correlation every time to get a null distribution of correlation values The problem with using the standard way of doing an inference for correlations is that these are not independent estimates, because each dissimilarity depends on two stimuli, and those two stimuli also co-determine many other dissimilarities. So then for all the images, we get a correlation of about 0.5, and that's highly significant. But we can also look at subsets of images. For example, within the inanimates, we get a similarly high correlation. And within the inanimates, we get a highly significant but somewhat lower correlation. And even between animates and inanimates, so for pairs straddling that boundary, when one is animate and the other is inanimate, there's still a correlation between how similar they are to monkey IT and to human IT. These human-to-monkey correlations of dissimilarities are significant also within faces, within bodies, within humans, within non-human animals, but they're not significant within human faces and within animal faces. So this suggested to us that perhaps there is a conspecific effect, that human faces are differently represented in the human, and perhaps animal or monkey faces in particular differently in the monkey. But this is a bit hard to really pin down based on our data, even though the effect is significant, so this seems to be the case. We also have fewer examples within those classes because we had so many other categories in our stimulus set. Finally, we can use this notion of correlating dissimilarity matrices to compare different brain regions. So, and this could be called representational connectivity. So the idea would be to ask how related are the representations across stages of processing within the same individual. And this would be sort of similar to functional connectivity in that it doesn't imply causality, it doesn't imply directionality in any way, it's just a symmetric measure of relatedness, but it would be a multivariate variant of functional connectivity. So when we look at this for the comparison between early visual cortex and lateral occipital, which is kind of the first stage, arguably, within inferior temporal cortex, and we look at the scatter plot, we see that there is a correlation also between these two regions. So it seems to be that early visual cortex and LO represent these images in some similar way at some level. And this might be a bit puzzling, because before I've shown you the matrix for early visual cortex, and it didn't show any of this categoricality effect, right? So this is actually something that only shows up in this representation. But these two findings are not contradictory, and this becomes obvious when we look at the marginal histograms of these different sets of dissimilarities. Then we see that in the LO matrix, the set of dissimilarities for the pairs that cross the boundary between animate and inanimate is shifted up. So there's a categoricality effect. In other words, whenever two stimuli are from different categories, then the dissimilarity is markedly greater. Whereas in early visual cortex, we don't see this this shift of the distribution for the between animate and inanimate pairs. So as a cartoon version, we see sort of two effects here. One is the category effect, which shifts the IT, in this case the LO distribution, up, because vertical is the LO dimension. And the other effect is sort of this correlation between them, which we think of as the visual similarity effect within these classes. So when two things tend to be similar to early visual cortex, and this is reflected in sort of the overall shape of the image. Remember, those were isolated object images, so they stimulate a particular a region of a particular shape retinotopically, And that's reflected in the early visual response, we think. And this also carries over to IT, but this categoricality effect appears on top of that. So another way of looking at this is in terms of this fiber flow kind of visualization that I've shown you before for the comparison between human IT and monkey IT, where we connect corresponding elements of these multidimensional scaling arrangements. And here we can sort of see how from early visual cortex to IT, the animates and the inanimates become disentangled and ordered into two separate clusters. So to summarize so far, there seems to be a natural categorical structure to primate IT. The top level distinction appears to be animate-inanimate. And also faces appear to form a separate type cluster. Then also we find a man-monkey match of IT representational similarities. We see matching major categorical clusters, as well as matching within category similarity structure. Our interpretation of this is that human and monkey IT may host a common code for continuous as well as categorical object information. But of course, many questions remain. Can this apparent categorical structure be explained by low-level features? For example, someone could come up with a simple low-level representation that happens to produce the same dissimilarity matrix, and then it wouldn't be very puzzling. And more generally, we'd like to ask what kind of computational model can explain our findings. So to go from description to explanation, we use a range of models to predict representational similarity. And those models can be computational, conceptual, or based on behavioral data. I'm going to focus on the first two variants here. So just as we can present our images to brains, we can also present them to models. And those models have internal representations, and they have nodes. Now, it's practically impossible to relate the nodes of a neural network model to actual brain data because of the correspondency problem, right? We don't know which node corresponds to which neuron, for example, and there might be different numbers of nodes than neurons. But with this method of comparing representational dissimilarity matrices, we don't have this problem because we only need to compare activity patterns to other activity patterns within the same model or within the same individual. And then we get this similarity matrix representation, which is indexed by the stimuli and thus can be directly related between these domains. And this is very attractive because it's sort of a meaningful higher level description, but it's also a very information-rich description simply because there are so many pairs of stimuli. So there are lots of numbers in these matrices. So we process our images into these different representations, for example, simple image transformations. And we also use computational models, like models of B1 simple and complex cells using Gabor filters. And we can throw in sort of arbitrary ideas we might have about what the representation might be like. For example, Alex Wade suggested that the LO representation might be similar to a radon transform, which is an interesting transform from computer vision, so we just throw that in as another model. So this gives us model dissimilarity matrices, and here on top I'm showing the human and monkey matrices again. Here, this one would be a simple conceptual model that doesn't actually process the stimuli at all, but where we just put a 1 whenever two stimuli straddle the boundary and a 0 otherwise. And here are a number of other models. It's a naive model just correlating the RGB pixel images, the V1 model, which is neuroscientifically motivated, and the high-level HMAX model, which is also neuroscientifically motivated. We see that this conceptual model sort of captures one component of these actual matrices, but this very simple model, the sort of early visual model, and the higher level model doesn't really capture this categorical structure that we see in the empirical data. So for early visual cortex, then we can, or for any given brain region, then we can see how well all the models match this brain region. So here on the vertical, I'm plotting the deviation from the early visual cortex dissimilarity matrix. So a zero would indicate a perfectly matching dissimilarity matrix. And based on the variation across subjects, we estimate the dissimilarity SNR, and that allows us to estimate how high we would expect the correlation to be between the early visual cortex matrix and the same matrix if we had had a different set of subjects, right? And this is sort of the estimated expected retest correlation if we repeated the experiment with different subjects. So finally, we can also estimate if we had the true model, which exactly captures the dissimilarity signal but not the noise, then this would be the level of dissimilarity between those matrices that we would expect. So now I'm going to show you a subset of the models from best to worst for early visual cortex, and I'm going to use this color code for other brain regions compared to early visual cortex, naive models like the stimulus image, neural models like the V1 model, and category models, which are just conceptual and don't actually process the stimuli. So perhaps somewhat depressingly, the best fitting model is the silhouette image model, where we just distinguish between figure and background pixels and then correlate those two binary images, essentially comparing the overall shape of the figures. And this seems to best, among this set of models that I'm exploring here, to best represent the structure of the patterns that we find in early visual cortex. And the other dissimilarity matrices don't seem to fit as well. Right FFA, right PPA, left PPA, left FFA, right FFA, the V1 model, the animate-inanimate category model, and a number of other models don't fit nearly as well. And here on the bottom you have the models that are significantly correlated, so that's quite a number. You can also do this for human IT, and in human IT we find that this conceptual model, this animate-inanimate model, is the best fitting model, and then the next four are all other brain regions. The best one is the right FFA, and the next best one is human IT, and then it's the left FFA, and then early visual cortex. The other models don't fit nearly as well. Another thing that we can do is relate all the dissimilarity matrices to each other simultaneously using multidimensional scaling, but now not on activity patterns, but on the dissimilarity matrices themselves. So then we get a sort of a plot like this, where ideally we're matching up all the models with all the brain regions, and we also see which models give us similar dissimilarity matrices for the set of stimuli that we have been using. So to summarize the model-based analyses, we compared a range of low and intermediate level model representations to the IT representation, and none of them could explain the categorical clustering we saw in human IT. Now, of course, that's an open-ended endeavor. You can never test all possible models. But our interpretation at this point is that an IT model probably needs to include category-specific visual knowledge, as might be acquired by supervised learning. So to conclude, I just want to mention a few general methodological concepts and sort of the general direction that we want to take this in. One is to combine representational similarity analysis with searchlight mapping. And the idea of searchlight mapping is just to take the voxel searchlight and then move it throughout the functional volume and compute some multivariate a statistic of pattern separation at each point in the brain to get a continuous map that shows us blobs, not of activation, but of information. And with the we can combine this with representational similarity analysis by just computing a local fMRI similarity matrix for the voxels within the searchlight at each location, and then comparing that location's dissimilarity matrix to all the model matrices. And so for that one location, then we get an entry for each model, and so for each model we get a complete map that shows us where this model fits well. Finally, we think that this approach of looking at representational dissimilarity matrices addresses a challenge that we're facing in cognitive neuroscience and systems neuroscience in general, which is to relate these major branches of research, computational modeling, behavioral experimentation, and brain activity measurement, to each other. These fields are largely separate, and usually when they're related to each other, it's often at the level of verbal theory or comparing results. Sometimes it's at the level of neurometric and psychometric functions, but even that is not sort of an information-rich way of relating them, because usually, you know, if you have a neurometric function, it just has a couple of numbers, whereas on both sides, on the side of the brain activity, you have thousands of measurements, and on the side of the computational model, you also have lots of parameters. So we think that this hard challenge of relating these can be met by using representational dissimilarity matrices as a kind of hub that allows us to compare all these things. Okay, I want to end there. Thanks a lot.
That was really beautiful data, but I want to ask you a conceptual question. You used several times the concept of the word that you could do similarity comparisons, for example, across species or across brain regions, and you use the term, it looks like information is recording similarly in these two because of your evidence. And I want to question whether your method can do that. I mean, the method is very good, these representative matrices, as saying the same stimuli within the same species within the same area, do they seem to be encoded similarly? But when you change the species, you could have very low dissimilarity or very similar dissimilarity matrices, and the information could be quite completely different. For example, suppose that the way, in a very perverse way, the way you go from a human brain to a monkey brain is by permuting all of the brain areas. You just permute and relabel the brain areas. Mm-hmm. That transformation leaves your similarity matrices untouched. You will generate the same conclusion, but the information will be coded a totally different way. Area A will be coding one thing in one species and another thing in another species.
No, this, I think, I mean, unless I'm misunderstanding you, let's say, for one thing, we're not looking at whole brain dissimilarity matrices, right? We're looking at a given functional region. So if you permute, so now there's sort of two levels at which you could do this permutation. You could permute all the regions globally in the monkey brain, in which case what you call IT would be some different region, right? And we've seen for the human that when you move to a different region, you find a very different dissimilarity structure.
All you do is you permute the information, you just relabel your voxels before you compute the correlation.
Okay, so this is the other way. Let's say you within a region, you permute all the elements, for example, all the voxels within a region. And this would not change the dissimilarity matrix at all, right? And this is a feature, this is not a bug, because it means that and if we did that in one of the species, let's say, this is one of the problems that this approach solves, that we have these spatial correspondency mappings, for example, for the human, we use Tallarax based or cortex based alignment, which is a little more precise, but we know fundamentally that spatial correspondency is going to break down at some level of specificity, simply because different people don't have the same number of neurons, right? So there will never be a neuron-to-neuron level spatial correspondency. But with this approach, we are sort of using spatial correspondency at the coarse scale, at which it works very well, but within a region, the spatial arrangement doesn't matter at all. You can rearrange the voxels, and the dissimilarity matrix will be invariant to that. So you can still compare, for example, individuals and species despite the lack of a spatial correspondence.
I don't want to take over some of this. I don't agree with you. We can continue.
Maybe I misunderstood you. We should discuss it.
I think the issue is whether it's the representation or it's the readout that are similar. Right? So it's the readout that is similar, not the representation.
Exactly.
Yeah, so yeah, this is a fundamental issue, that's true. So if that's the one that you were referring
it's
to.
It's the same thing, what you said just very quickly. What you're saying is within regions, for the issue of different scales across species, I agree that's a feature, not a bug. But suppose that you're interested in the amygdala, for example,
yeah,
and you look at the whole amygdala. So it's called in the central network or in the basolateral amygdala, you care a lot, and the permutation issue that you just explained kick in the same way. So that becomes a bug, not a feature.
So the question of readout, of course, this is what information that we see in a region that is actually used functionally by other regions, right? And so when from the data we have, a region looks identical, we cannot know whether it's read out in different ways by other parts of the brain. So yeah, I agree that is sort of a separate question that needs to be separately addressed, and that we cannot draw conclusions about with this method.
I have one more short
question. Yeah, I have a different question. Excellent talk. My question is, have you tried in the model some hierarchical models, like where you have V1, V2, and V3, like to build this similarity matrix? So not having one model, but having a hierarchical model as we expect that the visual system works. And
so we've looked...
Can you say what she asked?
Okay.
Yeah, whether we've studied, if I understand it correctly, we've studied sort of how the hierarchy of visual regions is reflected in the dissimilarity.
So if you had one of your models reflect the hierarchical of the visual system, like did you test a hierarchical model, a model that would reflect the hierarchical structure that we expected to see in the visual system?
Some of the different models that we use, like the V1 model, would represent a low level of the hierarchy, right? And the HMAX model is an IT model, for example, that's the higher level model. We haven't used sort of a global overall model that has many different stages and then matched up all the stages, but that's a very good idea. You should do that.
You might be able to tune the model based on your similarity metric.
That's another great idea to actually... when we build these models, we're usually using training in order to set the parameters. And one way of going about this would be to do a category training and then look for different images, whether we can reproduce an empirical dissimilarity structure. But Janina is suggesting another way of doing this, which is using empirical dissimilarity matrices as something to be fit in with the model by adjusting model parameters, and I think that's a very interesting direction. Yes.
Okay, let's thank our speaker.